Call to order the Senate Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. Today is Monday, February 9th. Today on our agenda, we will have an informational hearing. Do we have the introduction of committee measures? We don't. We'll have an informational meeting on that will be an overview of the siting process for energy facilities, and then we will have a public hearing on Senate Bill 258 and 259. So we're setting aside about half an hour for the informational hearing and have a chance to get a presentation from the department. Committee members will have a chance to ask questions of them, and then we'll move into the public hearings on Senate Bills 258 and 259. So that's what we're going to be doing. So with that, we'll open up the informational meeting or hearing on the overview of the siting process for energy facilities. Is the department here? I imagine.
Yep, coming up.
Todd?
Yes.
All right.
I thought I could just. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. First question, where is the secret transmission line going? Just kidding.
That's a tough one.
You would start off
a little levity to kick off a hearing about a process that can be somewhat contentious at the local level.
All right. Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Todd Cornett. I am the Assistant Director for Siting at the Oregon Department of Energy. I believe Mike Kaplan is on the agenda as well. He's unable to make it today, so it will just be me providing the presentation. So I have provided a handout. This will be similar to what's on the PowerPoint presentation. Included in your packets are also several handouts that go along with it. I will refer to those in my presentation, but they are not in the actual presentation. They're intended to be for future reference. So, like many programs, ours begins with a high-level policy, and that policy is to for a comprehensive system for the siting, monitoring, and regulation of the location, construction, and operation of all energy facilities in the state. And I think the key term in here is a comprehensive system. So as I'm going through the presentation, you'll see how that plays out in our process. I would say that it is very comprehensive in nature. So just to start with some basics in our process, it begins with the Energy Facility Siting Council. So this is a 7-member council. They are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. That is the first handout that I'll refer to. So it includes all of the council members, the current council members. So if you look at that, they are fairly geographically representative. They have diverse professional backgrounds. And they are the decision makers for all energy facility decisions. So they are the final decision makers in basically everything. The Department of Energy is, the department itself is about 110 employees. The siting division, at least this fiscal year, is 14 FTEs. Next fiscal year, we're proposing to be 12 FTEs. So we are the primary staff to the Energy Facility Siting Council. So we work with the applicants. We do the majority of the analysis and make recommendations. But again, ultimately, it is the council that makes the decisions. Our process is a consolidated review, and I think that's a key term. The way our process works is any state agency, any local government agency that would have had jurisdictional authority, that gets folded into the Energy Facility Siting Council process. There are some exceptions, but the vast majority of those permits, standards, all get folded into the Energy Facility Siting Council process. Again, going back to that kind of comprehensive term. It's a standards-based process. This is important to note because if you look at our process, look at the steps in our process, some of the language, it sounds somewhat like the National Environmental Policy Act. So the NEPA process that's governed by the federal government, it functioned actually more like the local land use process in the state. And that being that there are standards that are established for every single facility, it's the applicant's burden of proof to meet, to show that they meet those standards. And if they can show that they meet those standards, then they are, the council is obligated to give them an approval. Another key distinction between the NEPA process is, because that's an impact-based process, they evaluate the impacts and look for ways to mitigate them. They also can request that the applicant look at a different location. That's not something that can occur in the FSEC process. Whether or not the proposal can meet the standards, the Energy Facility Siting Council or staff cannot request that the applicant look at a different location.
Really quickly, Todd, before you move on, is this process apply to all energy facilities, or only energy facilities of a certain size threshold?
Chair Edwards, only facilities of a certain threshold, and there's a definition of that, and I'll come to that as well.
Okay.
But I can describe to that now if you'd like me to.
No, go ahead. You get to it.
Sure. So at the end of the process, the permit or the decision is what's called a site certificate. So you'll hear me in my presentation talk about a site certificate holder. The difference between a site certificate and a permit is a legal one. So while it functions to some degree like a permit, it is actually a business contract between the state of Oregon and the developer. So there are different legal implications. And finally, at least on this slide, are the application fees. Our process is 100% cost recovery. So for the Department of Energy staff, for our contractors, for our Department of Justice support, all of that is 100% billable to the applicant. For reviewing agencies, state agencies, local governments, they have opportunities for reimbursement as well, and I will refer to that in another slide. So, Chair Edwards, getting to your question regarding the size thresholds. So, ORS 469-311 is that definition. So, when we use the term energy facility, it is actually a definition that's in statute. And that statute lays out very clearly the types of facilities that are under the Energy Facility Siting Council's jurisdiction, as well as what the actual thresholds of those are. People are typically familiar with wind, so that would be 105 megawatt nominal or 35 megawatt average. Solar, that got changed in the 2013 session, so now it's 100 acres on high value or predominantly cultivated agricultural land, 320 acres on other lands. That's for photovoltaic. Solar thermal would be 25 megawatts. So those are all very listed specifically in that statute. One kind of point, the Energy Facility Siting Council does not have jurisdiction over hydroelectric facilities. Those are with the Oregon Water Resources Department. So anything that is not defined as an energy facility in this statutory definition that would fall lower than that would be a local government jurisdictional review. And then there's the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and they have standards and requirements for when things go to FERC. So reviewing agencies, and this is a term that's defined in administrative rule, and this includes the state agencies, local governments, tribes, federal agencies, others affected by the proposal. So these are all entities that throughout the process we provide the notification to. So for the reviewing agencies, we send them at least five times. So five official times in our process, and you'll see the red font kind of throughout my presentation when they're provided that notice. So various times we ask them at the beginning, what are their issues, what are their concerns, if they were going to be doing the review, what their permits would be. Later on, have we evaluated the proposal correctly like they would, what their conditions of approval would be. So there's a lot of interaction between these reviewing agencies. Because they're such an important part of our process, we've worked pretty hard in the last several years trying to better incorporate them into our process, to better educate them, make sure that they understand how our process works, when they get incorporated into our process, and how to most effectively and efficiently work. We do an annual reviewing agency training now. That's happened 2 years in a row. We've done it in Eastern Oregon, in Southern Oregon, in Salem. So we've had some good responses and participation. We do better outreach to local governments. So that's something that we recognized, that there was some confusion and they didn't really understand exactly how what their role was. And so we've tried to do a better job of that. And this seems pretty basic, but we provide them information in whatever way they want. So the way the rule had previously been written is they would just be given everything in paper form. Sometimes these are large amounts of paper. Now we will provide it to them in electronic or paper or both or whatever they want. So we've tried to adjust to make it easier for local governments and state agencies and others. For cost recovery, currently only state agencies and local governments have the ability to get reimbursement in our process. So the statutes very clearly outline how that happens. They have the ability to enter into a reimbursement agreement with the Department of Energy, and then they can request reimbursement for work when we send them out notices and requests for an evaluation. The Senate Bill 259, which I'll talk about later, looks to add three additional opportunities, two for state agencies and local governments and an additional one for tribal governments, which currently don't have the ability to get reimbursed. The public is also a key element to our process. Like reviewing agencies, we have an obligation to provide notification to them. There are at least four official times in our process where they're notified. Because we want to make sure that they can also track our process in the best possible way, we've done things to try to make it easier for them. So we've provided notifications where they can sign up for any single project or any combination of projects or council meetings. So they get then email notifications if they weren't a adjacent property owner, which is what our legal requirement is to provide notice. We have started including our energy facility siting council meetings on a webinar. So somebody can not just have to either drive around the state to go to them or listen on the phone. They can track it on a webinar, see the presentation, and if the facility where we're at kind of allows it in terms of the technical capabilities, then we also have for the presenter and the council members, we have them on video feed as well. So again, trying to make it better. Probably the most important thing that we've done is we've really taken a hard look at our website, and each project page is now consistent. It is fully laid out in terms of the entire process with descriptions. And as the process proceeds, either notices or documents start to get included in there. So all that information, they can see the entire process laid out. It's a long process. It's a complicated process. We know that, and so again, these are things that we're trying to do to make the process work better for people.
I have a quick question about that. So on the slide, you say receive information at least four times during the application process as public stakeholders. So is that you informing the public, or is that you hearing from the public? Who's receiving the information? You're receiving information, or they're receiving information, or both?
Chair Edwards, so that slide references the time that we send information out to them. Okay. So there's four particular times that we send information out to them. There are several times where they can actually provide information to us as well. At the notice of intent stage, that's a comment phase. At the draft proposed order hearing phase, and then at the draft proposed order hearing itself, and then potentially in a contested case. So if somebody wants to continue to participate in the process, there's at least four times where they can provide information into the process.
Okay, thank you.
So the standards that are applicable, and there's a handout which describes the council's standards. There's a couple of slides that are handouts that refer to those. So the way that it works is you have the council standards. Those are listed in administrative rule. You have any state laws that would be applicable to that proposed facility. You also have local ordinances other than local land use regulations. And these are fixed at the time that the site certificate or the amended site certificate is approved. or the term that's used in statute, is executed. So those can change all the way up until the date that the final decision is made. However, local land use regulations, so these would be local land use and development ordinances and comprehensive plan provisions that are required by statewide planning goals, that's a requirement in statute, those are fixed on the date that the application or the amended application are submitted. So there's a difference in terms of those two, and this will be discussed further in Senate Bill 258, because that's one of the main issues that's in there. It's also important to note that an applicant can choose what's called Path A, and that's as described in our rule, is they can request that the entire local land use be reviewed by the local government. Or they can choose Path B, which is folded into the Energy Facility Siting Council process. To my knowledge, they have all requested that being included into the Energy Facility Siting Council process. So there's one process, one appeal path, no variation. I think there's good reason for that, that they choose that. Another point is in the Path A, if it is a local government review, local governments are subject to the goalpost rule. So if it did go Path A, then they would be subject to the timing that's required for all other local land use permits as well.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair. Is that true also for projects that move through different local government areas?
Chair Edward, Senator Dembrough, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, I mean, if it's something of a transmission kind of thing where it might affect different locales.
I see. Yeah. Chair Edwards, Senator Dembrough. Yes. Yeah, so that same opportunity exists for a linear facility, whether it be a pipeline or a transmission line. If an applicant wanted to choose Path A and have, it would be obviously more complicated because then they would have a series of local land use decisions, and then that would get into issues of alignment and conditions and other things like that. But yes, that would be an opportunity for the applicant. Site certificate amendments, this is also an issue that is going to be discussed in Senate Bill 258. So in the administrative rules for the council currently, there are three main types of amendments. And these are, the first would be a change in the boundary or the legal description. And the way that process works is the amendment, the review of the amendment, would be limited to that area of expansion. It would not subject the entire facility, the entire approved facility, to a review. It would subject only the new area to the review, and that would be subject to, going back to the prior slide, you know, all of the state laws and council standards through to the end of the approval or local land use regulations at the time that the amended application is submitted. The other second one is to extend construction deadlines. This is what we refer to as a general reopener. That's not a statutory or rule term. That's just a term we use because that is one where it actually does subject the entire facility to all any new regulations that have changed since that original approval. So if there are no changes, then that's a fairly simple review. But there could be significant changes in local land use regulations or state laws that then that facility would have to reestablish compliance with. So that's a general reopener.
So with the general reopener, then is it starting over if there have been changes? Or say the last part that you said again, because I'm not sure that I tracked it all the way through.
Chair Edwards, it's a general reopener in that it is subject to reestablishment, but it is not. So only changes that have been made in local land use regulations or state law. So that facility, as it was approved, if there are no changes, then the only evaluation would be on the extension kind of provision.
Okay.
But if there were state council standards, then whatever that standard changed to, the entire facility would be looked at, and any part of that facility that was applicable to that standard would have to be reevaluated and made sure that it was either still in compliance or there may be changes to the decision or changes in conditions. So there is some variation in the magnitude, but it is the opportunity to reevaluate the entire thing. Did that answer your question?
Yep. Okay. I got it.
And the third amendment listed here is to the facility itself or to the site certificate itself. So within the confines of the approved facility, if the site certificate holder wanted to make a change, they wanted to add a piece of equipment or change a condition, similar to the first one, it is just that aspect of the change that is reviewed against whatever current regulations have been put in place. So not the entire facility.
Senator Dembrough.
So what happens in the case of, you know, let's say, you know, think in terms of a wind farm or, you know, an individual wind turbine, which I don't know if this ever happens, but you have a turbine of a certain size and then it's replaced by a larger one that perhaps requires a different kind of transmission line, which would need to be moved elsewhere because of its magnitude. You know, does that happen, and does that restart a whole process of siting decision for the line that gets it from the windmill to whatever the main transmission trunk?
Chair Edwards, Senator Dembrough, the short answer is yes. So whatever the change is would be subject. So if it's, we have something similar, or we occasionally have these where the timeline to get an approval and to construct can be long, so the technologies can change. We've had in the intervening time after an approval request to amend a facility to increase the size of a wind turbine because there's new technology on the market. So that change in size has to get reevaluated against potentially everything, because it might change, you know, the noise, it might change the visual, it might change various things. If they wanted to add a new transmission line, then yes, because that would probably be in a new location, or even if it was within the boundaries of the approved facility, if that had not been evaluated, that entire transmission line would have to be evaluated against all applicable regulations that were in effect when the amendment was submitted.
And does that, and that also applies to not only something that's in the planning phase, but, you know, when you're actually replacing one turbine with another, that you would need to go through the process in order to be able to do that?
Chair Edwards, Senator Dembrough, yes, we haven't gotten to the life cycle of some of these facilities yet. So we don't have that specific example in terms of experience, but you've accurately depicted it. That's what would be required, is if they wanted to replace an existing one, say the nacelle or the turbine blade needed to be replaced and it was a different size, or there were variations of that, unless the original site certificate contemplated some variation, then they would have to come in and go through an amendment, and that proposal, that amendment, would be again subject to whatever was in place at the time that they submitted the amendment.
Thank you.
For how long is the site certificate valid or good?
So the Chair Edwards, typically there's not a set timeline to begin and complete construction. A typical time frame would be 3 years, 2 to 3 years, within the site certificate. And so they would be required to begin construction in 2 years and complete construction in another 2 years, or 3 years and 2 years. There's some variation in that.
So it's case by case, this is for this particular project. You must begin construction within 2 years and finish within four or within three or whatever.
Chair, that's correct. There's nothing specific in statute, but that's the general timeline that's typically included. Again, there's some variation of that, but that's typically what it is.
Thank you.
There are two other amendments that are worth noting. One is a transfer. They're a little bit different than the other ones. That's when a facility changes ownership and we have to go through that process, and that's technically a transfer. The last one is to apply subsequent rules, and this is related to when there is a public health and safety concern based upon new regulations. So this would be likely not the applicant submitting the amendment, but a third party making a request to the Energy Facility Siting Council that there was a significant threat to public health and safety, and that the council should make the amendment and apply those rules. The burden on there is of the person making the request to show that significant threat. I'm going to skip this slide because I'm going to go into the steps in our process, which this lays out. So the notice of intent is the very beginning of our process. This is where the applicant has just a conceptual plan. One of the handouts I have that I included in the packet details what those requirements are for an applicant, but it's really to get an idea out there of what the proposal is. And so this goes to the public, and this is the first time that the public might hear about it, but this is a comment time frame for the public. So the notice goes out to them. They have a chance to comment and indicate whatever their concerns are about the facility. This is also the first official time that the reviewing agencies, the local governments, the state agencies get this. As I'll discuss further in Senate Bill 259, there ends up being quite often the consultation with local governments and state agencies prior to the submittal of the notice of intent. But this is an opportunity for the local governments and state agencies to provide the staff, if they were going to review the facility, what would their standards be, what would their permits be, and those get then evaluated. So this is also a time, one of the things that we identified was that this was a key time to make sure that the reviewing agencies really understood what the facility was and what the process was. So we, this isn't in statute or rule, but we include now an optional, I say optional because it's not in statute or rule, but an interdisciplinary team meeting while we convene the local governments and state agencies to make sure that they're completely aware of what's being proposed and making sure that we can answer any questions that they have. The project order is the next part, and this is a document that we produce and send to the applicant, and this is really the blueprint for the application. This tells them, based upon our evaluation of what they want to do, based upon the comments that we've received from state agencies and local governments, you know, what their standards are. So in addition to the 16 council standards, and there's a handout of that in your packet, it includes all the local government regulations, all the state agency regulations. So this can change. If in the intervening time prior to the submittal of the application, local land use regulations change, then we'll amend the project order. Or if state rules or council standards change later on, then we'll amend the project order. Or if the applicant proposes something different, then we have to evaluate that and also amend the project order. The next is when the applicant gets the project order, they take that, they evaluate it, and then they submit their preliminary application. So this isn't, this is the requirements that they have to submit to us so we can evaluate the proposal against the standards. So this is the second time that it goes to reviewing agencies. We send it to them and we ask them, again, what are their issues, what are their concerns, what conditions would they provide, did the applicant do a good job providing the information? So we evaluate it, we get their comments. If the application is missing information, then we go through what's called the request for additional information process. And depending upon how significant that is, that can take some time as well. Once the application is complete, so whether it's complete the first time or whether it's a round or two of requests for additional information, then we will deem the application complete. And it's important to note that the complete application does not necessarily mean approvable. It just means that there is sufficient enough information with it, with which to evaluate the request and make findings. So this notice of the complete application goes to reviewing agencies again. We ask for their comments and thoughts. And then this is the second time that it goes to the public. And at this point in time, we convene a public information meeting in the general proximity of the facility. And the idea of the public information meeting is not to receive comments from the public, but it's to make sure that they understand what the applicant is proposing, what the process entails, and to prepare them for the draft proposed order hearing, which I'll talk about in a moment. The draft proposed order is the next phase, and this is the document that after we evaluate the complete application against all of the applicable standards, the council standards, the local land use regulations, any other state rules, we make findings of fact and conclusions of law in a recommendation form. So that's this document where we've done our initial evaluation, and it's ultimately going to be a recommendation to the council. But we provide a notice of this. This is the fourth time it goes to reviewing agencies and the third time it goes to the public. And this is important because this sets up the draft proposed order hearing. And that's, as I indicated previously, that this is the only hearing, the only official completely open public hearing in the process. Later on, the ability to participate narrows. But here, anybody who is made aware of it can provide comments. They can provide written comments. They can come to the hearing and testify. Historically, this has been in front of a hearing officer. We've heard a lot of concerns from the public that they don't get a chance to respond or to provide that information to the council members who are the ultimate decision makers. So we've adjusted, and you know, it's our intent to make sure that the council members are available and participating in these so the public can actually testify directly to them. After the end of the hearing, the staff goes back, does an evaluation of the comments received by the state agencies, local governments, by the public at the hearing, and then does a presentation to the Energy Facility Siting Council. So the council looks at that, takes it all into consideration, and makes recommendations to the staff in order to convert the draft proposed order into the proposed order. And so this is just the next iteration of that document, taking into consideration the comments of, you know, all the agencies and people that I just spoke about. That proposed order is issued. It goes out to reviewing agencies that commented. It goes out to the public, again, number 5 and number 4 times that they're sent out. And then the notice of the contested case. Now, this only goes to those individuals who have either provided written or oral testimony during the draft proposed order hearing, because that is a raise it or waive it hearing. If you fail to raise an issue during the comment time frame in that hearing, you will be excluded from participating in the rest of the process. So only those people who raise an issue during the time frame that's under council's jurisdiction can then, as a result of getting the notice of the contested case, request party status and request that their issue be raised in a contested case.
So, Todd, because the prior hearing is raise it or waive it at that point, how many times is the public noticed about this prior, and how much time do they have to, you know, if they're opposed, if they have concerns about whether or not the project meets the standards, I mean, do they have 24 hours, or do they have 90 days, 6 months?
So, Chair Edwards, going back to the complete application time frame, that's where we're trying to set up that idea to make sure that people are completely aware. We don't know at that point when the draft proposed order is going to be, but we, at that point, in that notice, we convey that the draft proposed order hearing is the next phase, and it's going to be raise it or waive it. We discuss that at the complete application information meeting. But then prior to the hearing, I would have to look. I believe that we provide at least a 21-day, if not a 30-day time frame for notice. And then there's typically a 30-day comment period within which to provide that comment. So the comment deadline typically ends at the close of that hearing, but there is anywhere between 21 and 30 days to submit comments during that comment period.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Senator Krasowski.
So the only other part of that, Todd, is that once someone raises a concern and they do get party status, are they limited to the only issues they brought up, or do they get to participate in other issues that have been raised by other people?
Chair Edwards, Senator Krasowski, they can participate in the issues that have been raised by other parties in that contested case.
Thank you.
So the contested case phase, now we've had a couple of these in the past, but historically, at least in the last decade or so, the contested cases, there have been no requests for party status. And so when that happens, there's an automatic contested case in our process, but The hearing officer, the independent hearing officer, will just open it and close it, and it'll be done with. We have two full contested cases that are occurring right now, and it appears that our process is becoming more contentious and there's more participation, so likely there will be more in the future. This adds a significant amount of time and cost to the applicant and the decision-making process. As I said, there is an independent hearing officer because this is an administrative law process. So it's kind of like in a built-in appeal, but it functions a little bit differently because it has very distinct administrative law requirements throughout it. It functions more like, to some degree, like a trial. So and parties, again, have to request party status. They have to raise their issues, and then there's a whole process that's laid out both in the Oregon Administrative Rules for the Energy Facility Siting Council and the Administrative Law Guide about how this works. At the conclusion of that process, the council will then evaluate both the contested case hearing officer order as well as the proposed order that staff produced, and they can their options is to either reject, modify, or take each one. And if the council elects to approve the facility, then again they can make whatever changes they want, which will become the final order, which is the final iteration of that draft proposed order converting to the proposed order. So it's the finding of fact document, but the final version, if they approve it, will also have to issue that site certificate, which again is that business contract between the state of Oregon and the developer. That decision by the council is appealable to the Oregon Supreme Court. So there's no intervening appellate bodies. It goes directly to the Oregon Supreme Court. It is, at least on the books, has a six-month deadline. And only those people who participated and raised issues in a contested case can appeal the decision. And they are limited to raising, appealing those issues that were raised in the contested case. At the conclusion of the process, if a county had a conditional use permit that was incorporated into the process, or a state agency had a permit, then the site certificate holder at that point would make that request from that state agency or local government, and they would have to issue those permits without any additional review or evaluations or conditions. And that's why it's important that we do a good job of incorporating them in our process, and that they do a good job of fully participating in our process, because they have an obligation at that point to issue those permits. They also have compliance responsibilities with regards to the conditions that come out of their rules and regulations. And again, this is something that I'll talk about in Senate Bill 259, is providing some opportunities for reimbursement for assisting the Department of Energy in evaluating those conditions of approval. So process improvement, this is always a good way to conclude. During the 2013 session, House Bill 2105 was passed, and that required the Department of Energy, and specifically the Siting Division, to evaluate several questions and make recommendations in the form of a report to this committee, the interim version of this committee in 2013. And so we did that. We took those questions. We evaluated that. The report was issued in October 31st, 2013. The report was presented to this committee on November 20th, 2013. It's important to note, and again, as I talk about the Senate Bill 258 and 259, the ideas, the concepts that are included in those were also included in that House Bill 2105 report. So if you look in the last couple of pages of that report, the ideas that are in those two bills are in there. One of the things that Senator Denbrough asked me when I presented that report was, well, what are you going to do with it now? And at that point, my response was that the intent was to convert it into an annual work plan. And I'm happy to report to this committee, being the same committee, that we are 6 months into our first work plan that came out of House Bill 2105. So we have numerous things that we've included in there, process improvements that we're trying to evaluate and do and make the process better. That's something that we're going to continue to do on an annual basis, and that was the outcome of House Bill 2105. I've talked about a couple of those with regards to reviewing agencies and the public. A couple other examples of things that we're working on currently is we worked with our IT department to create a records management database. There have been inconsistencies in the past between different siting analysts, and as I've described, the process is somewhat legalistic in nature. It's important that we have a good, consistent, accurate record, and so we now have a database where everything can go in the exact same way. So, you know, in the event of a Supreme Court appeal or a contested case, we have ready access to all the documents associated with that record. We are working on updating our pre-application guide for applicants. So this is something that we have already, but we think it was a good opportunity to reevaluate it. We want to make sure that the applicants are as prepared as they can be prior to submitting an application or amendment and during the process. So we're working on that. We're also going to be looking at a project management tool software. We want to make sure that all of the siting analysts function in a consistent way and the most efficient way possible. So we're going to be looking at a project management tool, which we think will create some efficiencies for us. And at least the last thing on my list is one of the other things listed in House Bill 2105 was the kind of the fees and cost tracking element, something that we've, we'll say, struggled with partly with the state system in the past. And so we have a limited duration fiscal analyst during this biennium, and we're requesting it for next biennium, and we have done a lot with that position. She has done a lot to give us there is a significant time gap in the way invoicing occurs between work conducted by an applicant or by a state agency and when it comes to our system, and then when the developer gets to pay it. So we're much better at tracking where each facility is at any point in time to know how much cost has incurred and, you know, where we're at in terms of our initial cost estimate. So something that we're doing a lot better on and sharing that information, and we'll share with that information with the developers. So with that, I will conclude my presentation, and I would be happy to entertain any questions you may have.
Thank you for the overview, Todd. Could you... Not right now, because we need to get moving on with the rest of the agenda for today. But could you get to me what the standards are? It seems like there are process issues, and then there are standards issues. And I think that there are some folks that like how the process works, some that don't like how the process works. And I'm trying to make sure that we've drilled down adequately to make sure that regardless of what the standard, if the standards need to be looked at, we're talking about the standards. If it's the process, we're talking about the process, but regardless, the process is fair and consistent. And some folks may not like the outcome, but maybe that's a standards issue, and maybe they just don't like the outcome, but that's just how it has to be. So if you could give me some more information about the standards that you're using, that would be helpful for me.
Chair Edwards, there are two handouts that I included in the packet. One is in a list form, and this includes the notice of intent requirements, the application requirements, and then the council standards. And then there's another one which includes a more narrative version of the council standard. This included in there, like Exhibit K or the land use standard, would be the local land use regulation. So some of the things might be a little bit kind of buried in the idea, but if there's anything anything beyond this that you would like, I would be happy to provide.
Okay. Thank you. This will be a good place to get started. So, okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Todd? Okay. Well, we're going to close the public hearing on the energy facility siting process, and we're going to open up a couple of public hearings. We're going to first open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 258, and a public hearing on Senate Bill 259. Todd, if you could start by presenting the bills, and then we'll move into public testimony on both. And if folks care to comment about both, they can. But I think most people are probably interested in 258. So, go ahead.
Certainly. Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Todd Cornett. I'm the Assistant Director for Siting at the Oregon Department of Energy. Thank you for the opportunity to provide an overview of Actually, I would ask the question, would you like me to start with Senate Bill 258 or 259?
258, please.
In addition to my presentation, I have submitted written testimony, which has been handed out to you. The Oregon Department of Energy is introducing and supports Senate Bill 258. This bill would amend ORS 469-401 in two ways, both of which relate to the applicability of standards in the Energy Facility Siting Council consolidated review process. So the first thing that Senate Bill 258 does is that it clarifies the apparent conflict between two statutes with regards to when local land use regulations are fixed in the Energy Facility Siting Council process. First, ORS 469-401 requires the site certificate holder abide by all local ordinances, state laws, and rules of the council in effect on the date the site certificate or the amended site certificate is executed. And again, executed in this context means approved. ORS 469-504 requires that applications be reviewed for compliance with land use regulations in effect on the date the application is submitted. So those are two very different things. Again, one when the site certificate or amended site certificate is executed, and the other when the application is submitted. So this issue was raised to the Oregon Supreme Court in a 2013 court case, the Blue Mountain Alliance versus the Energy Facility Siting Council. So the Oregon Supreme Court in this case recognized this conflict, which I just described, and concluded that the requirement in ORS 469-4012 that a site certificate comply with local ordinances, state laws, and FSEC rules in effect on the date the site certificate is amended does not include any ordinance, law, or rule that is a land use regulation for the purposes of ORS 469-504 sub 1 sub b. So what Senate Bill 258 proposes to do is to change the statutes to be consistent with both this ruling of the Oregon Supreme Court as well as the Oregon administrative rules, which both in two locations fix local land use regulations at the date the application or amended application is submitted and not when the site certificate or amended site certificate is approved. This is how the process works currently. The second thing that Senate Bill 258 does is it eliminates the possibility that all site certificate amendments could potentially be construed to require a general reopener. So once an energy facility is approved, there are many reasons why a site certificate holder would like to amend that site certificate. They could be very significant, they could be fairly minor. But currently, the Energy Facility Siting Council administrative rules describe exactly what local land use regulations, state laws, and council standards are applicable to those two specific types of amendments. The first being some change within the facility itself. So, as I indicated, this can range from being minor to significant. The amendment in this case would be subject to an evaluation of current land use regulations, state laws, and council standards. However, no part of the overall facility, just the proposed change, would be subject to that evaluation. The remaining facility, the pre-approved facility, would not be subject to that review. The second one would be a change in the project footprint, so an expansion of acreage of the facility. So anything within that acreage would also be subject to the entire suite of regulations that were applicable on the date that the application was submitted. But it would not subject the entire facility. Facility might be approved in operation for 20, 30 years. That entire facility would not be subject to that evaluation, just the expanded area. Only the third one, which I've described before, is referred to as a general reopener. And that is only when the beginning or ending construction deadlines are requested to be amended. That is the only amendment where the entire facility is potentially subject to all new regulations or all changes in regulations, those that are effective on the date that the amendment is made. So that's a general reopener. In 1999, the siting statutes were amended to clarify that amended site certificates had the same legal status as the original site certificate. That change happened throughout the ORS 469 council-related statutes. In most instances, well, since 1999, there have been no known, to me at least, issues related to that. Until recently, we, the Energy Department of Energy staff, have evaluated two of those places where that or amended site certificate language was included in 469-401. And we have a concern that the in those two locations, that that additional language could potentially be interpreted to require a general reopener for all amendments, not just the ones that are the beginning and construction, beginning and ending construction extension deadlines, but all amendments could be interpreted to require a general reopener. Again, facility could be in place for 20, 30 years. They request some amendment. Only currently that aspect of that amendment would be subject to a review, not the entire facility. Our concern is there could be an interpretation based upon this language that would require a general reopener for everything. Our intent, therefore, is to remove that language that was put in place in 1999. We evaluated the idea of going beyond that, but we simply tried to go back to what existed prior to 1999. So that was the proposal. Again, this is how the system currently works, and this is what we were trying to ensure continues to work in the exact same way. So in summary, Senate Bill 258 will conform the statutes to the Oregon Supreme Court's decision in the Blue Mountain Alliance versus FSEC, which affirmed that local land use regulations are fixed at the point an application for site certificate or amended site certificate is submitted to the Department of Energy. And second, it eliminates the possibility that all site certificate amendments could potentially be construed to require a general reopener, which subjects the entire facility to a reevaluation of all current local land use regulations, state laws, and FSEC standards.
Okay.
So, thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that concludes my presentation on this. I'd be happy to go into the other one or entertain any questions you may have.
Any questions on for the department on 258? Go ahead.
Thanks. Thanks, Mr. Chair. So going back to the scenario that I brought up during the informational session, so, you know, if you were to have a windmill that where, you know, finally that day has come and you're swapping out a smaller one with a larger one, that might or might not trigger a general reopener. Let's say it was just a change in the transmission line that might send that new transmission line over terrain that it wasn't previously over. That would perhaps it would trigger a general. Most likely, it wouldn't under this scenario, but there would still have to be a process around the resiting of that transmission line. Am I correct in thinking that?
Chair Edwards, Senator Dembro, it would not require a general reopener. At least under the current process, the current rules, the process would be limited to just the proposed change. So if it was adding a transmission line, just that transmission line would be subject to all current local land use regulations, all state standards and council standards that are current, but it would not subject the entire facility. So when I use the term general reopener, it's the entire facility. So once a facility has been built in this instance, then it would not be subject, again, under current rules and regulations, under a general reopener. It would just be that specific change that's being requested.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Go ahead.
Okay, let's just say, for instance, there's a transmission line that's been approved already down a county road, and then a year later we kind of figure out that, it's going to be too big, or it won't work here. We're going to need to move it over and go across this acreage. that includes all kind of public, private land, whatever. Will this change affect that, having to move that transmission line that was approved to go down a county right away? Won't they still have to go through this whole process too of amendment, and this language will not affect that?
Chair Edwards, Senator Thompson, no, our intent with this language is it would not affect that, that a change as you describe, relocating a transmission line, say if that's part of part of a larger facility, that entire relocation would require an amendment, and that would be subject to all current land use regulations and all current state standards and council standards. So our intent is absolutely not to change that. Yes, sir.
Just to follow up.
Yeah,
follow. I got several emails about this, a lot of angst about circumventing local ordinances and stuff. But it's my experience as a county commissioner, when if there was ever a wind machine type farm proposal set up, they almost always chose the Energy Siting Council review, which is really, really rigorous and tough to do. But at the same time, if you could meet the standards of that, of their standards, it was way and above most of the county and state laws anyway. But then you didn't, it was just kind of a way of not having to go through local land use rules that got appealed all the time and in that section. So as long as it doesn't affect that, then I'll probably be good with it.
Chair Edwards, Senator Thompson, again, our intent is absolutely not to make that change, that the all local land use regulations would be applicable as they currently are.
Senator Olson.
Yes, thank you, sir. You just said something that kind of piqued me a little bit. You said all current local regulations would be applicable, but if the application is suspended and it's perchance a local rule changes after the process has been suspended, that new change would not be applicable to the amended process, would it?
Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, I'm not sure I completely understood your question in terms of the issue about suspension. But I'll answer it in this way. If an applicant came in and submitted their application, the local land use regulations currently are fixed on that date. So if those local land use regulations change prior to the decision by the Energy Facility Siting Council, those new local land use regulations would not apply to that facility. Does that answer your question? Or
it kind of does, and thank you. Follow-up, please. Mm-hmm. I know one of the concerns that I've heard from the people that have talked to me is the fact that, and I don't know if this is an accurate description of it, but a farmer goes out and he buys some land to increase his farm acreage, and then finds out that some transmission line wants to go across his land. And he's made a purchase in good faith that this is all going to work out, and all of a sudden the transmission line comes in, and then maybe perhaps the transmission line is delayed for some reason whatsoever, and we have an environmental issue perhaps, or maybe an ESA issue, which changes the whole conscript of that purchase. But it can't be changed now because this people that want to do the transmission line have already made their application, and everything after that time at the local level stops. So there is no opportunity to mitigate anything at the local level because of this wall, the barrier that they've hit. Is that what you're telling me?
Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, there is no real suspension in our process. So it's really whether or not the applicant meets the construction deadlines or not. And if they can't meet the construction deadlines, again, it could be 2 years, it could be 3 years, in order to begin construction, and then, you know, another 2 or 3 years to complete construction. If they can't meet those, they can request an extension, and that is currently happening, you know, with some of the wind facilities. But based upon that request for an extension, then that is a general reopener, and all the current land use regulations at that time would be applicable.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, you want to present 259 as well, and if you could consider the clock.
Sure.
When you do that.
Chair Edwards.
There's a lot of people that want to test.
Vice Chair Olson, for the record, my name is Todd Cornett, Assistant Director for Siting at the Oregon Department of Energy. I will boil this one down very quickly. So Senate Bill 259 does three things. All three of them are related to the availability for additional reimbursement for reviewing agencies in the Energy Facility Siting Council process. The first is at the notice of intent phase. So as I previously described, that phase is the very beginning, the applicant's general concept, their general idea. Many developers will want to consult with a local government or a state agency or multiple to identify potential issues prior to submitting the notice of intent. We think that's a good practice. We would like to encourage that. Currently, the statutes do not allow for reimbursement by local governments or state agencies until the notice of intent is submitted. So the first thing that the bill would do was allow for that reimbursement, but only at the applicant's request. We don't want to make this, you know, a significant thing. There's value to the applicant, and it should be the applicant making that request for themselves. And so that would be the limitation. It would be their determination of whether they wanted to do that. So that's the first part. The second part is, as I've indicated, with state agencies and local governments, there are ongoing compliance responsibilities in the FSEC process. So once the site certificate is issued, there are conditions of approval which the Oregon Department of Energy staff must rely upon state agencies and local governments. Review of a habitat mitigation plan by ODFW is a good example. There is no express authority in statute to allow for reimbursement of that assistance to ensure those conditions of approval are complied with. So the second thing that the bill would do would allow for that opportunity for reimbursement for the state agencies and local governments. The third is related to tribal governments. In the Energy Facility Siting Council process, prior to the notice of intent, the Legislative Commission on Indian Affairs identifies which of the nine tribes could be affected by the proposal. They are a reviewing agency then throughout the entire process. So we have an obligation, we, the Department of Energy, to send them all the information, the notice of intent, the application materials, and request their comment. They typically comment on cultural, historic, and archaeological resources. We think that's a valuable part of our process. We want to encourage it. There is currently no authority to reimburse them for that work. So the third thing that the bill would do would add that element to allow for that reimbursement, similar to state agencies and local governments. It would be subject to a cost reimbursement agreement and then them submitting invoices. I will note that we have received some amendatory language from the utilities on this bill. We have not had a chance to evaluate those in full yet or respond to the utilities, but we appreciate their interest. We appreciate the fact that they took a proactive approach and submitted some things, and we're happy to work with them. I just don't have anything to report on that aspect right now. So with that, I will conclude my presentation.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much, Todd. And next, we were going to open up the public testimony. And again, when I call you, if you have comments about either bill, feel free. We're just going to go through, because I think everybody that signed up to comment on 259 is also on the list for 258. So please use your time to comment on both if you wanted to say anything about 259. So we're going to start off with Commissioner Givens and Tamara Mabbitt, and I apologize if I did not pronounce your name correctly.
We get along.
Hopefully. For the record, I'm Umatilla County Commissioner Larry Givens. And Chair Edwards, I would like to express my thanks for being able to be here and and testify today regarding proposed Senate Bill 258. I will make some remarks, and I need to preface, however, we've submitted a letter from Umatilla County Board of Commissioners, I think, and hope each of you have a copy of that, that you've had a chance to look at. It was signed by two of us. We did vote in a Board of Commissioners meeting. We were all unanimous in opposing this proposed bill. However, Commissioner Elfrein was on vacation. We did a phone conference. He is supportive but was unable to sign the letter because he was out of Umatilla County at the time. I will refer to the letter in my comments, and I will not read the letter. All of you've looked at it, and as a commissioner and a former teacher, I get somewhat annoyed if somebody thinks I can't read, so they feel like they have to read something to me, so I do not do that. I will refer to portions of it. We understand that Bill 258 would create for the Energy Facility Siting Council two sets of standards, and some of those have kind of been talked about in Mr. Cornett's earlier testimony. One of them would be for land use, and another for all other siting standards. Some real significant differences here. We felt, as we looked at it, it was contrary to good public policy. This was not a standard that we wanted to go down, or we thought the state should be going down. And it's especially contrary to goal one, and that's public involvement. And I'll give some examples here a little bit later. The bill states that Senate Bill 258 would reduce the voice of local government. Doesn't state that, but our interpretation would reduce the voice of local government in permitting energy facilities because it would limit the consideration of local land use standards to a time certain in the process, and that's at the preliminary application. And as you looked at earlier presentations, we're thinking the NOI, or notice of intent, and not the completed application. Of course, developers want to see that because they want certainty in their project. They don't want to have to keep thinking they may have to change. By comparison, land use permits are valid for 1 year when we're talking about extensions. With FSEC, that's not the case. They can extend them for a longer period. At the end of the 1 year, if the project hasn't been completed in land use, then they can be extended for another year. But then that's the limit, and they have to reapply. When we think about two sets of standards, I want to give you an example. As an example that we sent for you to use, if the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife lists a threatened species after a developer has filed an application with FSEC, the new regulations for protection of that species is incorporated into the FSEC permit. But if a county adopts new land use standards after the preliminary, or the NOI, application is submitted, then and that's done maybe to protect Goal 5 resources or farmland or a neighborhood, FSEC would not require that the application be submitted to new local laws or ordinance. So there's a limit there that we could definitely see. And we don't know why we would want to have two sets of standards. That's a slippery slope that I don't think anyone needs to or wants to go down. I would also like to draw your attention, and I think you may have it before you, and it was a letter that was submitted by Wendy L. Kellington, attorney at law, who sent this letter to the Board of Commissioners. And her summary, and of course we've relied on our own legal counsel and looked at what Wendy Kellington had submitted also. Senate Bill 258 provides that no state land use legislation and no governing body land use ordinance that was not in effect when the energy facility application was first submitted can ever be applied to an energy facility siting proposal. And she had four bullet points. No matter how many years elapse between the application for an energy facility and the issuance of a site certificate. Second, no matter how many times or how significant an application for an energy facility has been amended, and no matter how many times or how significantly a certificate is amended, and no matter how severe the amended proposal impacts are on ag operations. This is not something we think we need to be going down. Our Umatilla County Board of Commissioners, myself and my two colleagues, are very much opposed to this, and we would like that on the record. I'll let my planning director give you some further. Again, thank you for your time today, and I appreciate that.
Thank you, Commissioner, for making the trip over. Go ahead.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Edwards and Vice Chair Olson. My name is Tamara Mabbett. I'm the Umatilla County Planning Director, and I've been the planning director in Umatilla County since 2012. I've been a professional planner in Oregon since 1991. I used to be the young kid on the block, and now I'm one of the more seasoned planners. And I'll share that with you because I want you to know that I do have direct experience siting energy facilities in Oregon, both as a local planner. So in 1995, we, at the local level with State Energy Facility Siting Council, permitted a really large natural gas combustion turbine project in Umatilla County, 550 megawatts. We now have two of those. After that process, and I was a planning director in a neighboring county, I was invited by then-Governor Kitzhaber to participate on the Energy Facility Siting Task Force. So governor at that time said, let's take a look at these energy facility siting rules and the role of the siting council. As part of that, the committee retained the services of Kogan Owens Kogan, the oldest, most experienced land use firm probably in Oregon. They recommended against passing the local land use process onto the state. And I disagreed because at that time my experience with FSEC was that they did a very good job of incorporating the standards. And remember, that was based on the experience of one standalone merchant plant, 550 megawatts. More recently, and I think about 2009-2010, I was invited when Governor Kulongoski had an energy facility siting team to develop a master plan, an energy plan for Oregon. Prior to that time, the state has an energy plan that talks about energy needs, but it doesn't really have a strategy about how to meet those demands. And as you know, public utilities, as part of their regulatory process with the Oregon Public Utility Commission, has to show the PUC how they will get energy. So at that time, we had some discussion about maybe changing how land use works. I was the lone voice there. And I'm here today to tell you I do think the system is a little broken, and I think Senate Bill 258 will really break it. So I share with you my experience because I have been a county planner for a number of years, and I'm very familiar with the statewide land use planning program. I think that there's a lot of misinformation about the bill. The Board of Commissioners are not necessarily opposed to changing some of the process for an amendment, but they are indeed opposed to treating land use standards separately and in an inferior position to all other state agencies. So as you heard Mr. Cornett explain, the time when they look at the local land use standards, our cutoff date, our goalpost, is when an application is submitted. And the historical practice of the agency has been to apply those standards that are in effect when a preliminary application is submitted. That's kind of unprecedented. Our goalpost rule in ORS 197 that we have to follow as professional planners is when we deem an application complete. So that is really the final voice when local land use laws are in effect. That some of these amendments would change that, but that's when it's in effect. The Supreme Court said, we think that's what the law says, and they codified it. We disagree in principle that that's a good law. What Umatilla County has said is if the goalpost standard can change for, as Commissioner Givens said, Fish and Wildlife Commission because they want to protect a species, we should also allow that to local government who might want to protect some resources or some houses or some high-value farmland. We're not opposed in Umatilla County to energy. We have both. We have renewable and we have natural gas facilities. We've permitted both. We were the first county to permit a commercial-sized wind energy project. We permitted those on the local level. It has functioned very well. We've also worked with state agencies when Path A, Path B, they chose working with the state agency. The state has said to me, both publicly and privately, that they're concerned that a local government may adopt standards that might prevent siting of a project. What's the role of local government? You stand up for people, not just for the project developer, but it's our job to make sure that projects are compatible with the underlying zoning. And in the most instances with renewable energy, we're talking farm ground, and this is one of the only industrial developments that we allow on farm ground. And it's not even an outright use, it's a use that's permitted conditionally. So a county could deny that if they so choose. Another point I want to bring out that I think Senate Bill 258 further exacerbates is the fact that there are two types of facilities in Oregon that we supersite: prisons and energy facilities. And with prisons, there's a very clear, public need to incarcerate criminals. And they've been very controversial over the years. I like to tell you that in Umatilla County, we have one of the newer prisons. That state siting process worked well, but you had a receptive county, a receptive port, and a receptive city. I'm not sure why today we still need a state agency to take the role of a local city or a local county that has an acknowledged comprehensive plan and acknowledged code. Where do we supersite a factory on private land and we hold that standard for the state higher than we do the local government? We just don't. And again, Senate Bill 258 exacerbates that. I would suggest to you that perhaps the focus of Department of Energy should be long-range planning, similar to the Oregon Department of Transportation. They do a stellar job. They develop lists. They develop demand models. We have transportation projects where there is an abundant and clear public need for an interstate highway, for example. Those highways are not supersited. Those highways are put on a comprehensive long-range plan at the state level, at the local level, and then they're permitted at the local level. There's no supersiting for an interstate highway. I have that point. I wanted to address a couple of comments that Todd Cornett raised. And again, I think this raises enough question about the proposed language that we would encourage you to either vote against Senate Bill 258 or at least entertain some amendments to it. The county's testimony also includes some amendments, and the effect of that language, which has been vetted by a county attorney and a private attorney, would be, again, to keep the county standard, give it the same respect that you would give a state agency. When Todd Cornett said their process is very much like the land use process, I think he's right. But then why not just make it a land use process? And if you're talking about a significant investment from a public utility, that's the role of the Oregon Public Utility Commission, not citing them, but to make sure they have the organizational, the financial wherewithal to develop and operate a large facility. I'm not sure why the local government can't do that. The projects are big sometimes, but we cite big factories. We cited a Walmart distribution center, and the footprint of that's much larger than a natural gas plant. That was all permitted on the local level. We didn't need a state superciting agency. So if the intent of the state is to streamline energy facility siting, I think if you followed Oregon's stellar statewide planning program, where you have projects on a plan and you permit at the local level, you're going to get your permit in 150 days. Why? Because the statute says you have to. If you follow the state process, it's usually upwards of 2 years. There were a few comments Mr. Cornett made about what's a general reopener and what's not a general reopener. We could tease through those things. I think what's important for you as the public policy folks is to understand that the local government doesn't have a voice in what's a general reopener. The siting council gets to decide. We at the local level may say, holy cow, changing a rotor from a 1 megawatt project to a 3 megawatt project, that's a lot. We might have questions about compliance with the state noise standards or viewshed or flicker or how the new transmission light might get to it. We don't have a voice in that process. That's the state. I've heard mention of an interdisciplinary team meeting. We have four projects, wind projects in our county, cited by FSEC. We've never been invited to one of those. I wanted to address Senator Edwards, I think the process, I think you're absolutely correct. There's concerns about the standards, and there's concerns about the process. I just think it's premature to give the state agency more authority than they already have. I do want to say for the record, these are my friends. I work with these folks. They're very professional. They have a good job. I just think it's time to take a look at the whole system. There's 36 counties. All the counties have professional planning staff. I think these projects can be permitted at the local level where there's an overarching public interest. If we can define what that is, that couldn't be addressed at the local level or with the Oregon Public Utility Commission, then maybe there is a role for that supersiting. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel?
Very briefly.
Yeah. Thank you very much for your testimony. It will be very brief. Thank you much for your testimony. Would there be any circumstance that you could foresee, if you were involved in the entire process, that a community uprising could push the path of the project off to the side because someone came in at the end and said, hey, we really don't want this now? Could that be a possibility?
Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, I think that could be a possibility. So I think as a matter of public policy, we have to decide where the overarching state interest is and where the interest of the local government is. If it's the state building an energy facility and there's a need for a state-owned facility, that happens in other countries, maybe you want to minimize the voice of the local government. And that's not the model that we use in Oregon, at least. And I don't mean to oversimplify the issue. I think that you can choose also where you cut off the local government involvement. And remember, those of you who have also been county commissioners, that legislative action of a local government is also not a quick process. So there's a lot of thought that goes into it. Those have to be vetted in terms of their constitutionality merit as well. So I think it is a possibility.
Right, thank you.
Chair Edwards, if yes. I might address it also. Chair Edwards and Senator Olson, Umatilla County 2 years ago, I believe,
2012
established some of the most rigorous energy facility siting standards for our county of any county in the state, and those have worked very well. So it's not something that they were developed to force developers out. They were developed to give some standards and some clarity to what we expected from a energy development, but also to protect citizens that had economic interest in the area where the project was being sited.
Thank you.
Thank you for taking the time.
I just have a quick question.
No, you don't.
Maybe it's not too quick, yeah.
Okay.
So I see a little bit of fear and mistrust in government in this proposal. It seemed that this, they came in and talked to my office and said, gee, this is just a little fix that they need to make sure, you know, it fits with the Supreme Court ruling, and it's really just a kind of a technical fix. But I think there's a lot, this has bred a lot of mistrust. It sure wasn't what, you know, when I first saw it, I go, all right, where are they putting this transmission line? Where are they going to sneak it in? That's what they're trying to do. And they came in and said, no, that absolutely isn't what they're doing. They're trying to tweak this. But I come from a county background, and there's folks that were all in support of wind machines and all the clean energy it would produce in eastern Oregon and for the rest of the state. Now people are sick of looking at those things because they're all over. And I think local communities have reacted and made new ordinances so that they could make these things. We still need them in our state, but I think make them a little more pleasable or easier to live with. So I understand what the agency's saying. If your standards are the way they are, and somebody comes in and wants to build a facility, they should meet your standards. But then, and then every month, you find something else to try to throw in there and change an ordinance, which you could do once a month if you want to. Probably takes longer than that.
That's it.
Yeah, probably 6 months. But and maybe they're trying. Maybe there's some of that going on here too. So I don't know. I don't. There's a little conspiracy theory here too, I think. But I know we at the local level, the folks know what you want there. And it seems like this is a little heavy-handed.
Chair Edwards, Senator Thompson, I sat on our county planning commission when we sited the very first wind project in the state of Oregon, mm-hmm. 14 turbines. And quite honestly, we thought, great, this is economic development, it's renewable energy. As we move through that process, and after the process or after the project was put together, we had learned that we didn't know a lot of things that we should have known. Not to fault the developer, but a lot of things we didn't know to ask came up. By that time, it was too late to go back and require changes. This is an evolving process. And we know that as people go through and they see the developments occur, more people are speaking out and saying, wait a minute, and you as a commissioner have gone through some of this, they're saying, wait a minute, let's have some better standards. I think they're saying we're not opposed to renewable energy. We want it to be done right, and we want to make sure that our citizens are protected. And as we've moved forward with numerous projects in the county, we have developed, as I said earlier, this standard for siting energy projects. It's very comprehensive, very rigorous. And we've done that to protect our resources, our citizens, and not just at the whim of maybe a conspiracy group. So.
Thank you. And I do appreciate your input on this, so in case I get a little flip every now and then. So
thank you
both for making your way over here and taking the time. And we appreciate your input on this bill.
So, Chair Edwards and committee, thank you very much.
Senator Hansel, thanks for why don't you go next. Thanks for taking the time out of your committee. And then after Senator Hansel testifies, we're going to go into panels of four at a time. And we've got less than half an hour to get through the remaining folks. So, Senator Hansel.
Thank you, Chair Edwards and members of the committee. I think the thing that is of most concern to me through this is that there's some real confusion with the language. There's real confusion as to what it means. I appreciate the
state your name for the record.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I'm not used to being in this chair that much. So. My name is Bill Hansel, Senator for District 29, of which Umatilla County is a part, in which I was a 30-year county commissioner there. So thank you. But the confusion seems to be in the language. I appreciate the Department of Energy stopping by and explaining, and basically what they said was that it really doesn't change anything, and they're trying to codify what a Supreme Court decision was. I missed their testimony, but I'm sure that was the gist of what they were saying. On the other hand, we're getting a whole lot of information. Well, it changes stuff tremendously, and particularly from the locals in my county, my home county, is that it's going to create a whole different ball game and a whole different playing field. So I guess my thought would be, if it's not going to change anything, number one, why do it? If we're going to do it, let's make sure we do it right and make sure that the language does, in fact, do everything that we would like to see it do. So that's basically, thank you for the opportunity to testify. Answer any questions if you have.
If there's any questions, I'll let you off
easy. Volunteering for the work group?
It sounded like it.
Yeah, that's what it sounded like to me.
We wouldn't do
You're
that
supposed to set up when he's walking away.
That's right.
I would
clearly
say
a rookie chair.
Senator Edwards, if I could help with a work group, I would be happy to do so.
Thank you, Senator Hansel. Okay, next we're going to go to Cindy Severe, Dave Price, and Richard Jolie and Irene Gilbert. I don't care who starts. You're okay. All going to get to talk, so.
Okay.
I'll volunteer for the lead.
All right.
And I'll try to keep it really short. My name is Dave Price, Umatilla County, a member of the Blue Mountain Alliance, and I was part of the Supreme Court case, which we've referenced previously today, and we make no apologies for that. Anyway, the issue dealt with the application submitted date, application executed date, as you've probably heard and read, and what happened in between those two dates. And what happened was is that Umatilla County, the local government commissioners, planning commission, and the people of Umatilla County saw a need to develop a new ordinance in regard to the wind development in Umatilla County. And there was a long process for that. And at the time that this application in question was submitted, the ordinance was not in effect due to legal challenges. At the time that the application was executed, it was. And that was the challenge in the Supreme Court, because we felt very strongly about that ordinance. And we felt it not only dealt with issues like you always hear about the setback and so on and so forth, but there was a lot of other resource issues involved, there was health and safety issues involved, and it was a very in-depth, comprehensive piece of local legislation. Now, we feel really strong about that, and the thing we're concerned about in this process here, to zero right in on it, is the language that's in this bill as we interpret it and how it affects the amendment process. Now, there's a lot of amendments going on, and there's some of these projects have been amended many times. And it's recognized that some amendments are very minor in nature. There's no question about that. But some of the other amendments involve double, triple the size and scope of the original project. And that raises a great big issue for everybody. In order, there's a considerable amount of time takes place in between the site certificate itself and amendments, and changes do occur, whether it's an ordinance like I referenced, or whether it's a resource issue, or whatever it is. Those changes need to be recognized in the amendment process. And we are afraid and concerned that this suggested legislation would prevent that from happening. And that is the major concern that I have. So I'll turn this over to the others, too.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Cindy Severe, 82422 Van Sickle Road. I have presented to you a documents that are a copy of my oral testimony, and inside the folder is a copy of my already submitted written testimony with documents to back it up. And senators, for the record, I don't believe in a lot of conspiracy theories. I'm here simply because I have experience going through the FSEC project process, and there was a project that was cited by FSEC around our property in 2009 and then again amended in 2011. I want to thank you, Senators and Chair, for the opportunity to speak here today, and I don't want to demean in any way, but I've never done this before, so bear with me. I have to read my testimony. I am so sorry. My hands are shaking. So
we're just normal people.
This is a first. I've never been to the Capitol.
We're sitting up a little bit, so that's the only thing that really.
Well, it's intimidating.
pretend that we're both having coffee at the local coffee shop.
Okay. Well, I will proceed with my testimony. I oppose Senate Bill 258.
How many pages of testimony do you have?
Just these little ones right here.
Okay. Just check.
Yeah, okay. It's very short.
Check. Okay.
Okay. As an affected citizen, I have been a participant in the Energy Facility Siting Council siting process. FSEC sited Helix Wind Power Facility in 2009 had major negative consequences for myself, my family, and our small property. The plans we'd made for building a new home had been put on hold. The time and effort to educate ourselves about the siting process and how we can both best protect ourselves and our property value has taken up more than 5 years. FSEC allowed the applicant to expand the facility from 60 turbines to 134 turbines on Amendment 1. It significantly changed the amount of acreage impacted, as well as the amount of rural residents that were impacted. The Oregon Department of Energy stated that there were no significant changes or impacts to the nature of this project. Amendment 2 of a time extension was applied for in 2012. This extended the time to completion of construction out to 2017. This is a span of 8 years. FSEC granted both amendments. Senate Bill 258 would allow the applicant to build a facility that has doubled in size, scope, and impacts on a site certificate granted for 60 turbines in 2009, exemption from current local laws. Oregon Revised Statute 469-401 sub 2 sets a new goalpost of compliance with local laws and ordinances when site certificates and amendments are applied for. The applicant is required to comply with all local laws and ordinances before FSEC will grant a site certificate or amendment. Senate Bill 258 circumvents the local laws and ordinances. To grant amendments without applying the local current laws blatantly denies the public due process. The bar for the public to meet the threshold of significant threat is all but impossible. I know. I contested the case on Amendment 2 on this very rule and was denied by FSEC on both amendments. Changes to laws at the local level allow for citizens protections in their unique circumstances. A great example of this is Umatilla County. In 2011, the county passed a new wind siting ordinance, UCDC 152-616-HHH, that the overwhelming majority of our county citizens demanded. I presented our Umatilla County commissioners, myself, with over 3,300 signature petitions in favor of a 2-mile setback from rural residents to turbines. If Senate Bill 258 is passed, current wind projects with site certificates could apply for amendments and bypass county law. Does the department and FSEC know better what the citizens of Umatilla County want than the citizens of Umatilla County? No. Impacts at the local level should be addressed at the local level. Energy projects that FSEC grants multiple amendments could be years in the future before construction actually starts. FSEC site certificate granted, no compliance with local laws required. Senators, I urge you, do not pass Senate Bill 258. This is an end run around the public by the Department of Energy and should be seen as such. Thank you. Is there any questions?
We going to do questions now
The panel? Yeah, we'll do them at the end of the panel.
Okay. Hello. Thank you, Senator Edwards and committee members. My name is Irene Gilbert. I'm a private citizen in Eastern Oregon. I'm also the legal research analyst for Friends of the Grand Ronde Valley. And I'm opposed to Senate Bill 258. One of the big issues for me is the fact that they removed the word amendment from the requirements to review current rules and laws, if you look at exactly what the language says. And so by not evaluating all siting rules at the time that amendments occur, they are basically denying the public opportunities for due process. And the reason that I say that is that there will be no requirement for a decision to be made regarding current rules at the time applications occur. If there is no official decision, there is nothing to appeal as far as a contested case. There's also nothing to take to the Oregon Supreme Court. So one of the things that occurs right now is the Energy Facility Siting Council has basically authority to make total subjective decisions without written objective criteria. And if you look at their site certificates over and over through issue after issue, it says no significant impact, no significant impact. I'll give you two examples of where there was no significant impact. Saddle Butte Wind Farm, on every issue it said there was no significant impact. Now the Department of Defense asked for a contested case hearing because they said that this development was going to cause a substantial threat to our national security. Now they requested that contested case just a couple of days after the quote-unquote deadline for asking for a contested case. They had been working with the department, they'd been working with the applicant ongoing, awaiting the results of a study that was being done to determine whether or not some things that they had done to try to protect the radar station that protects the West Coast between Canada and California. The results of that study were that their mitigation methods had not worked, and so they were concerned about adding additional turbines because they basically said it was going to make that radar station ineffective. The Energy Facility Siting Council refused to allow them a contested case hearing. Now, I just was at a Energy Facility Siting Council meeting where they allowed a developer to, several months after the deadline had passed for asking for an extension, came to them and said that, gosh, we thought we were going to be selling this, and so we didn't ask for it timely. Well, they allowed the developer to go ahead and process that amendment to extend the time frames. Another example is the Department of Navy has asked for a contested case hearing because of impacts on the route where they train new pilots in low ground maneuvers, new pilots. The Department of Energy's stance on this, as well as the applicant, is, well, if we put wind turbines that are 500 feet tall in the middle of this 3-mile corridor, what they need to do is just raise the level where they're doing their low ground maneuvers to 1,000 feet above the ground. Well, that's a problem to me. And given that these kinds of decisions are being made, it's critical that the public, at a minimum, have a right to due process. That is, if they're asking for an amendment, they need to be looking at all of the impacts. And one of the rules that the Energy Facility Siting Council has is that they're supposed to look at cumulative impacts of these developments. Now, mine's all scribbled up, but I did provide you in your packet a picture of what it looks like when all these individual little facilities are approved without looking at the total impacts. You end up with an area where you have county-sited facilities, you have state-sited facilities, and there is no room left. And for those of you who are thinking that, gosh, we're out of line if we think that there are some problems with the rules related to energy facility siting, I'd like to just quickly read over some of the issues that I see because the legislature has approved bills in isolation rather than looking at total impacts. Some of the things, The Energy Facility Siting Council should be required to look at and apply federal rules. Right now, they will not apply rules, endangered species rules, as far as migratory birds or golden eagles. They will not follow the ODFW rules regarding habitat mitigation. Those rules say that they have to look at quality of impacts to habitat as well as quantity. All they're mitigating for is the footprint. What that results in is a 13,000 acre facility like Saddle Butte is going to provide 26 acres of land protected to make up for all of the impacts to habitat. We should require them to quit using a threshold of concern where they say that an arbitrary figure, you can kill this many birds, you can kill this many bats per megawatt of energy before we look at requiring any kind of mitigation for all these deaths of animals. And that maybe they should have something other than drive slowly, drive on the roads, and we'll talk to you about where these animals might be as their quote-unquote mitigation. Require them to call more than just the nest of animals category one that is protected. If birds stay in their nest without going out to get food, that would be fine. But unfortunately, they do leave their nests. And require them to allow a contested case anytime the impacts of a amendment would have been required to offer a contested case if it were in a site certificate. And I can tell you that of all of the amendments that have been contested, they have never allowed a contested case on any amendment of a wind farm. I know in one that I was involved in, there were 14 different issues. None of them were considered substantial enough to qualify for a contested case, even though they were adding over 13,000 acres to the development. I think Oregon should get credit for all of the renewable energy we're generating in this state, or stop providing subsidies for wind farms that are sending their energy out of state. Require an actual review of the combined impacts, that is the cumulative impacts of all of these facilities together, which is what the rule says, but it's not being done. Remove the use of may and significant from the rules. Right now, because of those, there is no standard, basically, for establishing these. And I'm almost done here with these, but and I'm not including everything, of course, but there are a lot of issues. The Energy Facility Siting Council is also approving other rules, like removal fill permits, water permits for wells and things like that. I can tell you that the way they're reviewing those right now is to show that the applicant has sent in an application for this. There is no actual review, and yet these agencies are required by the statutes to issue a permit if the Energy Facility Siting Council issues a site certificate or an amended site certificate. That is a big deal to me because there really isn't a review of things like water, the water impacts of water, and they don't have the expertise to do that, and they're not doing it. Let's see. They also ought to be updating the material when an amendment request goes through, and they do go through the process. They're using the original site certificate and saying, gosh, it was okay at the site certificate, so now it's okay at the amendment. And when you get the list, I know you asked for the list of things that they review. I guess one of my final comments would be there are a bunch of things listed there where they don't deny site certificates based on things like views, public services, and public services include things like fire protection. It includes traffic impacts. It includes impacts to water supply of the local communities. They cannot deny a site certificate because of those kinds of impacts. That is a local issue that, to me, needs to be addressed. They also can't deny based on agricultural, or pardon me, archaeological or cultural things. They end up doing things like saying, with the Oregon Trail, you can't build a turbine any closer than 50 feet from the ruts of the old Oregon Trail. So anyway, I could go on. I have several other things that I know I'm probably boring you all, but
well, we appreciate your testimony and your passion around this, Linda. And when we met a few days ago in my office, I could see that you had a lot to say about it, and I appreciate you being okay. Over here. We do have some other folks that want to testify as well. And
yeah, thank
5 you. O'clock is 6 minutes away, so.
Thank you for your time. I would love to talk with any of you individually. I apologize, Senator Thompson. I did not. We had an appointment. I did not know about it. I had asked for one, and you sent back, and I'm horrified that I missed it. But anyway,
I'm
maybe
sure
another
the
time.
I'm sure the Senator won't hold it against you.
Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Linda. Go ahead, sir.
Edwards and committee. My name is Richard Jolly, and I'm president of Blue Mountain Alliance, and we've been working on siting wind development since 2008, and it's all about planning, and that is what we took a look at first is the siting processes that were in place. So as far as a conspiracy theory, we've been working with the our county and the Energy Facility Siting Council for a long time. And when we saw this come through, it adds to the conspiracy theory when on the third day there's a bill coming through that we had never heard anything about. And it just so happened that it was pointed out to us, and we wanted to kind of alert a little bit to ourselves to take a look at it because of the wording change. So we sent it to our attorney, and we feel that it was warranted to do so. There was no conspiracy theory about that, but when the Department of Energy is getting a lot of their salaries paid by the developers, it seems like that's who they're working for the most part, to get the projects done. And we're not against wind turbines or anything like that, but proper siting for the livability of Oregon is a big issue. Look at what we've done. She has a map here of our state, and when you take a look at all the projects going across there, we have built a dam basically across the Columbia Echo region there between the Cascades and the Blues, which is a major corridor for bird migrations north and south, and we're not even doing full counts. FSEC isn't on wildlife, avian deaths. They're required maybe 5 years, where our county, before we even got involved, was already having them do avian counts for the life of the project to see where they're at. And we need to take a look at all the impacts of the cumulative effects that we're doing for the livability, not just for us locally, for our whole region. I commend you guys for taking and getting an education on this, because it is so complicated. I've got 30 years in the power industry, and there's so many layers to what we're doing to ourselves and what could be right with it. Shoot, if they'd build a turbine that would take the 100-mile sustained winds off our coast, they would be viable against the hydro. Well, we're against the wording for Senate Bill 258 because we echo a lot of what our county has said already, and we feel that the Oregon touts its planning goals and the system that it has, and now we're thinking of circumventing that to some extent and taking the power away from the citizens. And thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Go ahead.
A lot of you mentioned that on an amendment process, the project's been accepted, made it through the Siting Council's whole deal. And then a year or two later, they bring an amendment or a change. I heard Mr. Cornett say that when the amendment process comes up, it has to meet whatever standards are at the time of the amendment is brought forward. Is that what you heard too? It seems to me that's what this is about. But I'm not hearing that from you folks.
Okay. Go ahead, Chair Edwards and Senator Thompson. Senate Bill 258 has generated a lot of arguable confusion, and that is where we're at with it. We're not saying that what they're proposing is factual, and by our attorneys and other attorneys looking at it, and if it's not such a big deal, they shouldn't even be spending their time doing it. We already took it to the Supreme Court, and it's a viable right there in of itself, and that's where we're standing with it at this time. If they wanted to change, work with our county and work to get the wording the way a better understanding when it's read, because when we read it and our attorneys read it, it's arguable right now.
Senator Przanski.
I apologize to everyone that's here that hasn't given testimony. As you know, I have a committee that starts at 5 that goes to 7, and last week, our last one, I missed 30 minutes of it, and I need to be more punctual. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you each for your testimony. Next, we have about two panels left. J.R. Cook, Bob Levy, and going to add Farm Bureau Representative Marianne Nash.
Either way, you're in the middle.
Whoever's ready.
Chair Edwards, members of the committee, my name is Bob Levy. I'm from Echo, Oregon. I'm not going to talk too long, but I'm going to give you a very short example of a personal experience with the process that on the front end that tells you how we have a hard time interacting with FSEC. First of all, I do agree, I do agree with what Tamara from Umatilla County said, that it might be time to look at the whole structure of FSEC and what it's for and if it's outlived its usefulness, and if a lot of this ought to be turned back over to the county. We have, in our area, many wind projects are located south of the high-value irrigated agriculture area. For a number of years, we've tried to figure out a way through the process to protect that high-value irrigated agriculture land from the encroachment of power lines and facilities that would take that land out of production. Estimates of the cumulative impacts to our area on that decrease in agriculture production could range as high as 3,000 acres. We currently have a couple of wind projects that have went past the initial application stage. They have the map that we got showing the power lines shows 5 different routes. When you ask which route they have chosen, they can't tell you. We also found out just recently that they may not even go through our county and may go through a neighboring county. So it's just impossible to work with this uncertainty. We realize the developers need certainty, but at some point the local community their concerns need to be taken into account. One of the problems with the siting of the power lines is that in one case the project is for an example, it requires a 69 kVA power line. That's small enough to fit down a county road. In another case, it's a 500 kVA line. That's the biggest power line they make. It's monstrous. It won't fit down a county road. One of them doesn't affect high-value ag. One does. We're concerned about whether we'll have any input into that process. I'll defer now to Mr. Cook.
Thank you, Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. I'm going to go off script. I'll just submit my written testimony. It's brief, just like my comments are going to be tonight. Bob's one of my bosses, so I got to be careful. But I represent the Northeast Oregon Water Association. We are an entity that formed kind of to bring our broad-based value-added ag industry together under one umbrella in Eastern Oregon to represent us both in water and protection issues such as this. And we're opposed to Senate Bill 258 for many of the reasons that Bob and Tamara explained to you today. Primarily, right now, there's a lot of ambiguity and generalization in the comments tonight, and the experiences we have aren't quite in line with what some of the comments were made on the process. And it's very clear if you look at Senate Bill 258, one comment where we heard automatic reopener. In line 17 of the bill, it specifically states the council may require compliance. And that's a big difference between shall and may. And many times in the history of the decision-making, when we defer to the council and the Department of Energy with what we believe to be significant modifications or changes, we're not always agreed with. And that usually leads to a lack of reopening in certain instances. And so amendments, reopenings are very vague at this point in terms of what qualifies and what doesn't. Time frame for development at this point, we don't really know what qualifies as 1 year, 2 year, 10 years in order to reopen. And until those are known, it's better left that we oppose any bill that continues to minimize the public involvement period, both with initial applications and amendments, until we know more from FSEC and from the process. With that, I'll leave it open to questions.
Thanks, Chair. Go ahead.
Chair Edwards, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee, my name is Marianne Nash, and I am the Public Policy Counsel for the Oregon Farm Bureau. As you are aware, Oregon Farm Bureau is Oregon's largest grassroots agricultural organization, and we represent about 8,000 member families. Our members own much of the farm and ranch land the energy facilities are often sited on. Prior to the Supreme Court's recent decision, it was our understanding that ORS 469-401 could allow FSEC to require compliance with local land use laws adopted after the preliminary application if those regulations address public health, safety, or the environment in a manner that was implicated by the project. In interpreting the current law, as you heard today, the Supreme Court found that local land use laws are outside of the scope of 469-401, as it currently reads, and said that the analysis of compliance with local land use laws takes place only under 469-504, which requires an evaluation of compliance with local land use laws in effect at the date the preliminary application is submitted, regardless of any changes that are adopted between that time and when the site certificate is ultimately issued. We're significantly concerned that codifying the recent Supreme Court decision is not the best policy decision for the state. Under the FSEC process, energy facilities can either go through local land use process or the FSEC siting process, as we heard. If companies are planning to site facilities that raise significant local concerns, this legislation would encourage them to go through the FSEC process and circumvent any changes in land use regulations that might be adopted after the project application is submitted, even if those laws address significant threats to environmental values like high-value farmland. FSEC should not be allowed to have a substantially different result than the local land use planning process, and it shouldn't be allowed to circumvent state and local land use planning priorities. So we would encourage you to urge the Oregon Department of Energy to step back from the process of codifying the Supreme Court decision and instead evaluate how to implement policies that best reflect the land use planning values of the state and local communities that are impacted by the projects. And with that, I will take any questions.
Thank you. Any questions of the panel? Thank you each for being here. And next we have Gary Bauer, Mark Nystrom, and Werner Seaman. Is there anybody else? This is the last panel of folks that have signed up. Is there anybody else, raise your hand, that wants to testify on this bill? Or either of these bills.
Got a chair for you.
You always have special privilege, Senator. Go ahead.
Senator Edwards, members of the committee, I'm Mark Nystrom. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. AOC is neutral on Senate Bill 258. We just met today to discuss it. There was a lot of back and forth on whether we should support it or oppose it. I just want to highlight that I think that we need to take a little bit more time to evaluate this. I would like to ask for a little bit more time so we can have some members have a longer conversation. I would like to thank the Department of Energy for being so transparent and working with us. They've met every request that we've had, but we'd really like to work on this a little bit longer. Thank you.
Chair Edwards, member of this committee, I'm Gary Bauer with Northwest Natural. I think most of the discussion so far has been around, sounds like wind projects. Northwest Natural does have a few site certificates. One of those happens to be for our Mist underground storage facility. It was a facility that was actually cited back in 1981. We do go in for amendments on that each time that, the facility is actually a depleted gas field. We took gas out of the ground, and then we now inject gas back into the ground for storage purposes, draw it back out during the winter to provide services to our customers. So as the need for more storage grows, we then go back and get an amendment to do another injection well. Those are things that, for us, having to go back and reopen the entire site certificate to talk about other parts of the facility seems pretty excessive. Now, we have had times where, along with that well, it's required a new compressor for injecting it back into the ground. If in that case, then the compressor and air quality issues and things around that are taken into account. So there are other types of projects, and amendments are necessary from time to time, and a process that allows you to kind of know what that process is, not have to go back and redo an entire facility is very important to us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Edwards, member of the committee, for the record, my name is Varner Seaman with Portland General Electric. Like what Gary said, PGE also has a number of facilities that have FSEC site certificates, and it's important to note that the site certificate is for the life of the project, so the full life of that project. So that includes some of the gas plants we have and includes transmission assets as well. So, for instance, we were in the process of trying to permit a transmission line. We ended up walking away from that project. But at the point that people were preparing towards the late stages of that process, the number of shelf feet for the volumes of documents involved in that permit, it was, as I understand it, 18 feet of shelf space for that permit. These are projects that, as Gary said, you come back and, you know, with a gas plant, you may change the use of an access road. You may change where a lie-down yard is for that plant. And if there's risk that at the point, say, 20 years into operation, if you come back to deal with something relatively minor dealing with the site certificate, that it opens up the entire permit, the entire application, and it puts all of that at risk, it starts to cause some consequences that I think could be pretty severe for those facilities. I think that if we don't have clarity that the entire application wouldn't be reopened, especially once a project is up and operating, I think it brings in certain questions about the financeability of projects. If the permit isn't an enduring permit, there's a certain amount of risk there that can be pretty problematic. When we talk about transmission lines, for instance, I mean, transmission line, when you put it in, is effectively, that's going to be there for a very, very, very long period of time. I don't think PGE is aware of ever removing a transmission line once it's built. So one of the concerns that we would have, and I think one of the things that we're supportive of in this bill and why we like where they're going in terms of the direction on 258, is making clear that if you're changing one section of a permit, you're not opening up the entire application. Thank you.
Yeah, Senator Olson.
Mr. Seaman, thank you much for your testimony. Would there be a possibility to put sidebars on 258 so that if, in fact, with a long-term proposal that you have, if we could make it where, because it's a 20-year or 30-year program, if you wanted to open something up and change an access road or whatever, as you said, that it could be opened up and looked at by the community, but yet still not affect the entire project?
Chair Edwards, Senator Olson, my understanding is that what we're talking about here is if you did change an access road, if you had something that was changing a part of the overall permit or site certificate, that portion of it, that portion that you're reopening, would be evaluated by the community. And as I understand it, with the standards in place at that time, and not opening up the totality of the permit. And I think that would be the goal that we have. And I think as Mr. Bauer was saying, if you put in a compressor, a new motor or something, it's reasonable to have it evaluated with the rules that are in place at that time and to have community input. That's not the piece that I would dispute, just to make sure that it's not cracking up the whole cracking open the whole application and bringing the, you know, that entire project in doubt. Because if you lose that site certificate, you know, at that point, then you have to close that project. You don't have a permit to operate. And that brings a pretty tremendous amount of risk, especially in assets that could be, you know, $500 million, you know, without exaggeration, you know, pretty expensive assets.
Thank you.
Questions? Comments? Short songs? Jokes?
Just real quick again, because this goes back and forth. So the court decision said you could do that, and now the agency wants to codify it. Because those questions got answered, correct? If you have a project that's in the ground, been there for 10 years, and you want to make an amendment and make a change to it, you don't go back on the whole project. Is that what the court decision was?
Chair Edwards, Senator Thompson, I'm not probably a good one to answer this. There are two parts in this bill. One is kind of the general reopener, and then the other part, I think, is addressing the court case. And I'm speaking more on the general reopening side.
Okay.
And that has been kind of the policy of the Siting Council, is to just treat the amendment as that, an amendment and not reopening. The bill is just kind of reasserting that. We weren't involved in the court case. I really don't think I could answer that. Thank you.
Thanks.
If you don't have any other questions, I'm going to, if you have time, I'll call the department up for one last round of questions if you want to get some clarification, because there's been a lot of said back and forth. And
I'd just soon do it later.
Or later. Thank you.
Chair, it's Gary Bauer, Northwest Natural. On Senate Bill 259,
oh,
just
yes.
wanted to reiterate.
259. Opinions?
That's kind of floating out there for a second.
Yeah.
Just that, as Mr. Cornett mentioned, we are working with the agency to try to put some sideboards around some of the issues in the bill, and we'll continue to work with them. Thank you.
Thank you.
Question on 259, if you don't mind.
Let's get Varner's opinion, 259, and then
okay.
Go to you.
Chair Edwards, I just want to meet too on what Mr. Bauer said. We're working with the agency. We're happy with the direction that we're going. We understand the reason behind the bill, and we're generally supportive, and I think putting some sideboards in is appropriate.
Okay. Yeah, Senator Olson.
Thank you very much. Either can answer. The concern that I had with 259 was that it seemed to be open-ended. You needed to do a route, and all of a sudden, hey, there's going to be a fee to it, but there was no definitive document that said this is what the fee is going to be. It seemed like it was just I could charge me whatever I wanted. Is that what you're looking at, or is it something different?
Senator Edwards, Senator Olson, yes.
Okay.
That's what we're talking about.
Thank you. We are not going to call the department back up. I think the department has heard what has been said. So if you could respond to some of the questions. I think Senator Thompson had a number of questions, and we will continue this discussion at another date, maybe. So for right now, we're closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 258, closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 259, and we are adjourned.
Probably have more questions. That's why.
And we are adjourned.